Welcome back to the Wealth Actually podcast, the show that features artists, entrepreneurs, experts, and commentators that will give you the right knowledge, planning, and guidance so you can preserve your assets and enjoy your wealth. Learn more and subscribe today at wealthactually.com. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes. It is neither investment, legal, nor tax advice and does not represent the opinions of the employers of the host or guest. And now, here's your host, Fraser Rice.
Welcome back to the Wealth Actually podcast. I'm Fraser Rice. In this 150th episode, we revisit the topic of citizenship and expatriation. Establishing a life outside the friendly confines of the United States is a popular wealth conversation. In the last few years, fueled by local dissatisfaction, political polarization, wealth divide animosity, and positive working abroad experiences, expatriation is now a big word in the cocktail party circuit. It's a word that shouldn't be taken lightly. Done correctly, it's a multi-year decision and planning process with significant consequences. Longtime friend of the podcast, David Lesperance, and fellow cross-border tax expert Melvin Warshaw share their expertise on the three levels of detachment from the USA. They will set out the administrative and tax consequences of moving up the ladder of rescission from the United States. David, Mel, welcome aboard.
Great to be here, Fraser.
Thank you for having us.
This is my first bite at the apple, having multiple people on the podcast, so the listeners can get to bear with us here as we stumble through things a little bit. But it's great to have you both on. We are in the midst of political craziness, uncertainty tax-wise. We have 2026 cliffs. We have income tax, who knows what. And I think in all three of our circles, we're seeing a lot of interest vis-a-vis what does it mean to stay in the U.S.? And that takes a lot of different forms. Maybe, David, talk a little bit about what you're seeing in your practice and what that means and how you sort of get people to frame that discussion and understand what the ramifications are there.
I've been doing this for three decades. Mel's been doing it a little longer, so he doesn't hold my youth and inexperience against me. But we've seen traditionally when Americans were looking abroad, they were either looking for just the opportunity of education or working abroad, or they were looking for some tax benefit. It was tax-driven, estate tax-driven, or trying to reduce or eliminate income and capital gains. But over the last couple of years, we've seen more of an explosion of clients who are looking for other motives, such as rising in political polarization and political violence, anti-Semitism, racism of various sorts, mass shootings has been another thing, just people feeling really unsettled. And this may be a dangerous analogy for a Canadian to be using for an American audience, but I tell my clients, imagine you live in a wildfire zone. What's your wildfire concerns? Well, it may be tax-driven. Oh my God, they're going to tax unrealized capital gains. It may be all the other factors I just mentioned or a combination thereof. And so that's really been the drivers. And we've really seen an explosion. While we still do get a lot of tax-driven, we've also seen an explosion of clients who are exploring these, we'll call fire escape plans, for non-tax reasons also, which are adding to it in the last few years.
So Mel, maybe center us here on what it means to be a U.S. taxpayer and what those attributes are, and maybe for some dramatic foreshadowing of the optionality you're thinking about for these folks, what it means to go from a full land-based U.S. taxpayer to maybe something else.
The two basic premises of U.S. taxation for income tax purposes, U.S. citizens and green card holders taxed on worldwide income wherever they live, with some exceptions for green card holders who might be able to apply a treaty claim and by filing a form AD 833. And then we have individuals who actually decide they want to live abroad but retain their U.S. citizenship. For that group of individuals, we have CFC reporting, controlled foreign corporation. The 2017 transition tax changed the entire landscape of how the United States taxes foreign income of companies. And we've got something called GILTI, which basically forces most of the active income to be currently taxed, unless you meet a couple of exceptions. And then there's always passive foreign investment company income, which have pretty nasty look-through rules and will cause a lot of heartburn because what I find is most U.S. accountants, 90, 95, 97%, except that maybe boutiques or big accounting firms, have no experience with 8621 PFIX, and it's a complete disaster. And then there's always the consideration of, am I going to make an investment in, or am I going to move to a treaty country? We have about 70 treaties, but we have no treaties with Latin America, no treaties with the Middle East, except for Israel. So where you move makes a big difference. You're going to move abroad and have income, earned income, living abroad. You get $126,500 foreign earned income exclusion, but you have to spend 330 days in a 12-month period outside the United States. Can't come back and forth. So there are opportunities for individuals who have assets overseas. I would say in the compliance area, where the Internal Revenue Service and the Justice Department, which litigates most of these FBAR cases, they've had a lot of success. And they've had a lot of success by cherry-picking bad fact patterns and going after big accounts and getting 50% civil willfulness penalties when people screw up. And you have to tell the truth, and you can't selectively tell the truth. There are some remediations that I get involved in, but they're very labor intensive and they get expensive, but they are effective as ways to clean people up, let's say before they want to expatriate. With that, I think I'll leave it there. Just one other comment, that increasingly I'm finding complete ignorance in the area of Americans living abroad who have foreign pensions. It's a world unto itself. Very little has been written about it. The IRS has been taken to task by the GAO, General Accounting Office, in providing very poor guidance to taxpayers and their advisors. And it's a complete trap for the unwary.
Trap for the unwary was the big flashing sign that was going in front of my forehead there as you were going through a list of the things you have to consider. Without forethought, you can just walk into all sorts of tiger traps there and forget the penalties and expense, just the annoyance of dealing with that and getting on all fours from a compliance standpoint. Sounds like you could really put yourself in a headache that really may not be worth
it. And Fraser, you're going to add to your accounting bills. What might be a $5,000 accounting bill for a return is going to jump to $25,000 if you have all these international returns you have to do, including a separate PFIC for each underlying investment that you have in a foreign mutual fund, a foreign private equity fund.
So, David, Mel has suitably scared me and probably all of our listeners vis-a-vis the tax components of it, but that's just one angle. It sounds to me like the other part of the decision tree here is understanding how much or how little you want to separate yourself from the United States, depending on your motivations there. Take us through a little bit about your thought process. Obviously, how much you stay in the U.S. versus somewhere else and maybe where you're a resident, that's a big part of it. And then continuum, do you go all the way to the point where you sever ties with the U.S. completely?
Going back to that wildfire analogy, some clients will say, well, I'm going to fight the fire. I'm going to vote. I'm going to register. I'm going to donate to super PACs. And I say, okay, but no fire chief drops a crew into a hot zone without having an exit strategy. So we look at alternative residences and citizenships as fire insurance. That ranges everything from, oh, I've got an Irish grandmother, or maybe a lineage claim, to, oh, I've been living abroad for a period of time. I can become naturalized somewhere, to these things called citizenships by investments. And there's also residence by investments. And one of the key differences between what we do is we don't take commissions. So we would flow that back. So we're completely unconflicted, providing agnostic advice. But then you have to put that fire insurance in the context of a fire escape plan. And they tend to fall into three different categories. And this is where the integration of the immigration and the tax is so key to success. Is it complex? Absolutely. Is it a DIY job? No. Do you want to rely on commission salespeople? No. But if properly designed and executed, it can have great results. So those three options tend to be what we'll refer to as the go bag option. Oh my God, there's been a hurricane. I need to bug out of my Florida place for a period of time. I'm going to live somewhere, but not so long that I'm going to become tax resident in that other jurisdiction. To the, I want to either have an experience abroad, kids going to school, or I don't like the administration that just got elected. I want to live abroad. So I'm going to be an American living abroad. And then you've got to deal with not only your ongoing requirements from a tax point of view for the United States, but you're also tangling with another tax jurisdiction and how those two interact, all the way to the full-blown expatriation, which is I'm going to permanently and legally and finally leave the United States tax system. That may be for tax savings. It may be that, hey, I've been living abroad. I don't want to deal with the complexities. I pay accountants a lot of money every year, and I'm hoping as I sign this that they know what they're doing, which is sometimes quite a leap of faith. And so clients say, you know, I just want to be finished with that. So variety of reasons, variety of solutions.
One quick follow-up to that. Having a separate passport, the idea of traveling under that, not all passports are created equal, is my understanding. The U.S. is still a pretty good one, as I recall. And then your choice of country where you end up, sometimes you can't just get a visa on the ground of the country you land in. Is that something you help people analyze?
So visa-free travel is, again, an issue. The United States has wonderful visa-free travel. You have to look at a number of different factors. So a negative for some people is the citizenship-based taxation that Mel was talking about. In other countries, the United States allows, it's accurately said, multiple citizenships. Most people just have two, hence the term of art of dual citizenship. Some jurisdictions don't allow dual citizenship. Some jurisdictions have military service assigned to them. Some don't have very good visa-free travel. Some countries, for example, all EU countries, don't just allow you to live in that one country. You have 27 different choices. Same thing, a Kiwi or an Aussie passport, you can live in both jurisdictions. Mercur passports allow you to live in multiple jurisdictions. So you have to take all of these factors into account. What's the benefits? What's the downsides? What's the cost? What's the timing cost, both in actual costs or physical presence or becoming a taxpayer or language requirements? You have to look at all of these options to find out which one is appropriate for your family situation.
So Mel, let's shift back to you for a second. You alluded to it, or I mean, more than alluded to it, you gave us a real good overview of some of the things you think about there. But as you go through the three different stages that David mentioned, how do you think about that from a taxpayer slash compliance continuum for the three options?
So in general, if individuals are going to bug out of the U.S. and let's say they want to move to Canada for a few months but not become Canadian tax resident, one of the things that David and I have talked about and we've implemented are these L1 intercompany transfers where someone sets up a company in Canada and the individual can then work in Canada and David gets them a work permit and they'll have to have some type of residence in Canada to go to when they're working there. But typically that means setting up a company in Canada. Bingo, that's a 5471 CFC that has to be filed every year with the Internal Revenue Service. And if you own more than 50% of it, then you're going to have pass-through of all the foreign income. And do you file a check-the-box election? There's a bunch of things that go into how do you report that income? And do you get any treaty relief? Because Canada's a high-tax country. You can see the sophistication there. And then, obviously, if you have a Canadian bank account, and it's not just in your personal name, but if the company has a bank account, you're an authorized signatory, you got to file an FBAR in the United States. And FBARs are separate and apart from tax returns. Then you've got situations, let's say someone thinks they want to move to Portugal. Well, likely David's going to tell them in this integrated fashion that they can no longer buy Portuguese real estate to qualify for a golden visa, let's say in Portugal, but they'll probably have to make an investment in a government fund. Well, they don't tell them over in Portugal that fund is very much likely to be a non-US mutual fund. We're going to be a Portuguese mutual fund. Bingo, you got PFIC reporting. So there's that type of reporting obligations that would come up in a go-bag situation. Now let's take it to the next level of the individuals moving their residency. So now that's a different story because the first question that I would ask is, are you moving to one of the 70 countries that has a U.S. tax treaty? That would be good because sometimes the tax treaty provides certain benefits as certain types of income are not taxed by one of the other countries. But that doesn't mean that maybe the person moves to the Middle East, to the United Arab Emirates, on a work assignment. Well, we don't have any tax treaty with the United Arab Emirates, and you don't get a foreign tax credit in the U.S. because there's no such thing as tax in general. It's coming, but it's not as of now in the United Emirates. And so there's a whole host of issues. The individual is moving to the United Kingdom. David can certainly speak to this better than I can. He lived there for 20 plus years, but the two parties are debating whether to continue the current non-dom system and remittance basis taxpayer. And there are new developments practically every day there for people who want to move there. And until today, an individual could move to the UK and structure their affairs so that they're only subject to UK tax on their UK source income. Don't know what the rules are going to be going forward, but in general, what you try to do is you try to get a foreign tax credit for any taxes you pay in the foreign country, creditable on a Form 1116 back in the United States. That's a broad generalization. We've got a couple of features of our treaties. One, savings clauses, where the U.S. reserves the right to always tax its citizens wherever they live, regardless of the treaty, and that can adversely impact people living just about in any country. Number two, there's an LOB or limitation of benefits clause in most of the treaties that the United States negotiates, which prohibits residents of third countries to do what's called treaty shop and try to cherry pick favorable tax benefits from a treaty. Again, this is all complicated, but it's worth the consideration. We can talk about some examples. David and I were on the phone this morning with a couple from Singapore, and we're discussing the timing of their coming back to the U.S. They both are long-term green card holders. One of them in particular needs to do some pre-abandonment of green card planning. So we timed out when the planning should occur, put a timeline on when the individual should abandon the green card, what part of the year, because we want to give them all sorts of favorable cash flow considerations. The fact that we can coordinate this between David and myself is very helpful in giving guidance to someone. The bottom line for this couple was a trip that they had planned for the spring is probably going to be postponed by 3 or 4 months because I need to do some pre-expatriation planning for the husband. He's got about $10 million of unrealized appreciation in some private Singapore companies that we don't want to pay exit tax on when he abandons his green card.
We're about to touch the thunder and lightning here, which is those American citizens who decide to give up the citizenship, which is something that gets a lot of attention. I find there's usually the people I run into, 99% kind of go down that road and then they pull back because it's complicated and it represents a lot of different things, not just financial and otherwise, that they end up staying away from it. David, maybe take us through your component of that and helping people think about the expatriation decision for U.S. citizens. And then Mel, maybe you follow on top of that to talk about what the actual tax ramifications and maybe the component of what happens if you come back or you touch the U.S. soil for too long.
Having grown up in a border city and having siblings who were born in the United States, I grew up in the Windsor, Detroit area, helped family members. I did my first U.S. expatriation in 1990, so I've seen all kinds of different issues. The first is you want to have another citizenship in order to give up the U.S. citizenship. So you may have one from birth, for example, Eduardo Saverin. He immigrated to the United States, still had his Brazilian citizenship. You may have it through a parent. You may have it because you were born in a jurisdiction which has birthright citizenship. You may have been living in another country and become naturalized. You may have lineage citizenship from descendants further afield. You may have a citizenship through, for example, law of return in Israel. So getting that second citizenship, we look at acquiring that and what's the timing of that. Because the U.S. allows you to hold other citizenships, simply acquiring it doesn't mean that you have triggered it. You then work in with Mel as to the, we have a renunciation appointment. Relinquishment of a green card can be done by mail, but for a expatriation renunciation, you need to make an appointment at a U.S. mission, consulate or embassy abroad, and renounce your citizenship. The actual renunciation takes an hour. We have a bunch of paperwork we do beforehand. but it's the organizing of that appointment. When you do that is key, as Mel will go through in his pre-expatriation planning timeline. You then expatriate. How can you travel back to the United States? Do you need a visa? Do you not need a visa? And then what's your port of entry? What's it going to be like coming back at the port of entry? One of the things when I was going through law school, I, as they say, wielded the chop. I worked for Canadian Immigration at Toronto Airport. So I was the guy on the other side of the desk. So again, over those 30 years, I've never had a client that's failed to get a visa that they needed or been able to enter. And I always like to tell clients, it's almost like the border official is saying, come on in, and the IRS is behind them whispering, and we hope you stay too long. And you trigger, for example, substantial presence and things. So it's the key, as Mel will go through his part, the key is having your immigration and tax strategy integrated, because an immigration advisor who's operating in isolation of the tax person is a very dangerous character. So the key is, when I first met Mel, we had a big Silicon Valley case, and I described myself as a tax-savvy immigration advisor and Mel as an immigration-savvy tax advisor. It was interesting. It's been great working with him, because it's been two unicorns meeting in the forest. Oh my God, you exist. Oh my God, you speak the same language as me. So it's working together. With that, I will then hand it over to Mel to talk about kind of the tax part of that expatriation fire escape plan.
Right. So Mel, before we turn you loose on what is a complicated and big topic, I think the typical cocktail chatter around expatriating is the exit tax and what that means and doesn't mean. And then where the cocktail chatter stops is what happens as far as presence in the United States and where the U.S. can pull you in if you inadvertently do things incorrectly.
One of the things that I'm going to mention, Fraser, is you can stay outside the U.S. and you still have huge U.S. tax problems. Whether you physically come back or not may be minor, as I will explain. So let me start with, there's basically two regimes, exit tax and inheritance tax, that we've had since 2008. The one that most people are familiar with is the 877 Cap A mark-to-market tax, which for long-term appreciated assets is 23.8%, subject to a one-time exclusion amount in 2024 of about $866,000. Gets adjusted every year for inflation. So it'll probably be around $900, a little over $900 next year. You can exclude the first $866,000 of worldwide appreciated assets. But let me start a little further back and say, who does this apply to? Well, it applies to all U.S. citizens who expatriate, potentially. And it applies, but only to long-term green card holders. Well, if I never get a green card or I get L1 visas because I talked to David and I postpone the date that I get my green card, well, maybe I won't make it the 8 of the 15 years as a green card holder preceding my departure. So some of the planning we do is trying to avoid even becoming what's called a covered expatriate. That's what you want to avoid. You want to avoid being a covered expatriate. For someone worth hundreds of thousands of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars, it's going to be impossible to avoid covered expatriate status. But there are some people, this Singapore couple, I've got a couple of strategies that we're going to deploy that I think will maybe get them to the point where they won't owe any exit tax. So who's a covered expatriate? It's all U.S. citizens. And only long-term green card holders, meaning if I was a substantial presence taxpayer for 20 years in a row, I can leave the U.S. without any exit tax implications. That's a big deal. Now, who's a covered expatriate? Three tests. They're in the alternative. You only need to satisfy one of them, and you're classified for life as a covered expatriate. You have a personal net worth on the day before you expatriate of $2 million. Pretty easy to meet that one and get to the other two. The other one that you might be able to avoid is that you have average net federal tax liability of $201,000 over the preceding 5 years. You get to take into account foreign tax credits. And then the one that some people don't really appreciate fully is you have to certify in writing on Form 8854, an expatriation statement, that you've been fully U.S. tax compliant for the preceding 5 years. And you not only have to certify, you've got to give the IRS a attachment to Form 8854 that says, here's a list of all the significant changes in my assets and liabilities for the preceding 5 years. So even if you filed a gift tax return 3 years ago, you got to still tell them again in the 8854, probably because the group that monitors 8854, LB&I, probably doesn't talk and communicate real well with the state and gift tax, which is where 709s go. And then there are a couple of exceptions. There's a minor's exception, very narrow, that when a minor reaches age 18, they've got about 6 months to perhaps try to renounce without being subject to a full-blown covered expatriate status. And there's also a dual citizen at birth exception. The exit tax can be higher than 23.8% if what you own, and I've had this, are short-term capital gain assets. You have short-term capital gain assets, that's going to be taxed at over 40% because it's treated as ordinary income. If someone owns collectibles, collectibles are taxed at 28%. There's a lot there. In addition, not only is there the mark-to-market tax, which I've just discussed, but there's three additional sub-regimes, one for ineligible deferred compensation called IRAs. And in general, you got to pay all ordinary income on your deemed withdrawal of your full IRA at your date of expatriation. So there are some strategies to try to circumvent that and to basically take an earlier distribution from an IRA so that you can get an offsetting foreign tax credit in the country where you're living.
Quick question before you go on there. For things like real estate, do you have to get a valuation for that and then pay the tax on that as well?
The IRS will tell you you don't, but I don't want to deal with that. I would say that if an individual has appreciated property in the U.S., maybe that's one of the assets they put into a pre-expatriation trust. That requires a separate discussion. The whole goal of planning, and we'll get to it momentarily, is try to transfer appreciated assets. So remember, if someone has cash, that's not an appreciated asset. But if someone has $3 million of cash, they may not have an exit tax, but they're a covered expatriate for life because they have a net worth of more than $2 million. So it's a little tricky. There's some special rules if you have eligible deferred compensation, like a 401k plan, very short time frame to give a form W-8CE to Fidelity. Schwab is the plan custodian. Then you may be able to get deferral of the exit tax by Schwab or Fidelity until retirement. And then there's a fourth regime applicable to interest in non-grantor trusts. The strategy for someone who's leaving is understanding that they're going to go from a world in which they get a $13.6 million lifetime gift estate tax exemption on worldwide assets to, at death, an estate tax exemption of $60,000 on U.S. situs assets. That's a huge drop, and it means there's a window of opportunity, typically in the calendar year before the calendar year of expatriation, to undertake planning. The planning consists of trying to give away appreciated assets, trying to give away illiquid assets, trying to claim discounts on the large expatriation that David referenced in respect to the Silicon Valley individual. We took huge blockage discounts, but 8% of blocks of stock over $100 million, that's $8 million for every $100,000 of valuation. So we went out and got a national valuation firm to give us blockage discounts. So all of this stuff is important to orchestrate beforehand. Now, I haven't even started to talk about the more onerous tax system. The cocktail party ends there. Oh, what about the exit tax? Well, people don't really know about eligible deferred compensation, ineligible deferred compensation. The IRS doesn't care. It's a realization on everything. So there's a problem. There's going to be a liquidity problem. But I still haven't come to the biggest problem. The biggest problem, once you're classified as a covered expatriate, it lasts for life. So go back to my example of someone who had $3 million, was in grad school, left the U.S., went back home, and then they inherit $100 million, they create $100 million, and when they left the U.S., they didn't have any U.S. children. Well, now suppose 30, 40, 50 years later, or 25, 30 years after they're gone, some of their assets acquired long after they left the U.S., they would like them to go back to U.S. citizens or U.S. persons. Those U.S. citizens, those U.S. persons have a 40% inheritance tax. it gets worse. There's no such thing as a $13.6 million lifetime exemption from inheritance tax. Everything over $18,000 is subject to 40% tax. It's vicious. It's onerous. And what I'll close with is to say, it doesn't matter if you don't come back to the U.S., you still have problems. Why? Take the example of our Silicon Valley entrepreneur who was very happy, moved to Switzerland, got a forfait in Switzerland because he promised not to work there, loves living outside of Lucerne, but a third of his portfolio, like most good portfolios, are U.S. securities. To the extent he owns the U.S. securities in his personal name, he has U.S. CITES assets subject to U.S. estate tax. So we have to put the U.S. CITES securities into a Swiss three-person partnership, file a reverse check the box election so that for U.S. estate tax purposes, it is a foreign corporation. Foreign corporations are effective estate tax blockers. Still doesn't end there. This individual has no family, no immediate family. All of his parents and his siblings are U.S. So the U.S. people are going to have an inheritance tax. If he dies intestate, or if he dies and assets come back to his U.S. siblings or his U.S. parents, they're going to owe 40% tax. And he hasn't come back at all. If he comes back, we can talk about it. There's some income tax monitoring as a resident. How long can you come back for? Does he come back? Depending, let's say this person has a Maltese passport, so they'd come back on the visa-free waiver program that David can explain further, but presumably the individual wouldn't stay that long in the U.S. But even if he doesn't stay that long, he's got the estate tax problems and the inheritance tax problems I just outlined.
I think that's going to be worth another podcast. Definitely the traps for the unwary part looms large. And one part to go back to what you were talking about before that I think is important is that this is a multi-year planning situation. You definitely need to get your affairs aligned the year before you're going through all of this, it sounds like. You certainly want a tax return filed that commemorates some of the planning ahead of time before you start going down this road. Is that an accurate appraisal?
That's accurate. The Internal Revenue Service takes the position. It's unknown whether it's accurate because no one wants to test it, but they take the position that an expatriate has a zero lifetime gift estate tax exemption in the year of expatriation. So you notice how I carefully said all planning has to occur in the calendar year before the calendar year of expatriation, because in the calendar year before the calendar year of expatriation, the individual should have the balance of their $13.6 million lifetime gift estate tax exemption available to them.
That plays into, so of course, a lot of tax planners right now are use it or lose it on the unified credit before assuming it doesn't get renewed at the end of 2025, but people are using it now for that pre-expatriation tax planning by using their unified credit to fund things in 2024, having their fire escape plan properly designed and implemented, having the fire insurance, all those elements, so that if they want to pull the trigger, depending on what the future holds in a new Congress tax-wise, they've got all the pieces in place. So they do all their planning. And just because you have fire insurance and a fire escape plan doesn't mean you need to trigger it. It just means that should you smell the smoke of tax the rich wildfire coming your way, you've got all the pieces in place. You've done them in the year before and you can pull the trigger. You're ready to go should it happen.
And you've got some moss growing under the transaction. I still believe in the idea that you pull all these things together and then you go and do something 10 minutes later, the IRS may take a dim view of that.
The way I view these pre-expatriation trusts, Fraser, is that the client is getting themselves optionality. A pre-expatriation trust is a completed gift, irrevocable, typically directed trust in a trust-friendly state. And clearly, people who are going to remain U.S. citizens are going to want to undertake U.S. federal estate tax planning, which includes trying to remove the post-appreciation, the post-gift appreciation from their U.S. estates. At the same time, that trust can also serve double duty if the person says, hey, in 3 or 4 years, I'm thinking of cutting the cord and leaving the U.S. The advantage of a pre-expatriation trust is twofold. Number one, the appreciated assets that were put into the trust in a calendar year before the calendar year of expatriation should not be subject to U.S. exit tax of the settlor, but rather the trustee would pay the tax when the asset is sold, so you don't have a liquidity timing issue. Number two, so long as the individual settlor who set up the trust was not, on the day they set up the trust, classified as a covered expatriate, any distributions made long after the individual left the U.S. to U.S. persons are not subject to the U.S. inheritance tax because the settlor was not a covered expatriate when they set up the trust. Again, these are things that are very technical. David and I understand them because we deal with them every day, and they're not necessarily obvious to a lot of domestic practitioners in the U.S.
It gets complicated very quickly. David, Mel, thanks so much for being on. How do listeners get a hold of you?
Hopefully in the podcast, you'll have our names and contact details, but it's David L'Esperance. You can find me on LinkedIn or L'Esperance Associates on the website, and just the info@david@L'EsperanceAssociates.com will find me by email.
I'll have all of that in the show notes. Mel, fire away.
I have a website, melvinawarshaw.com, and you can go and look me up there, or you can send me an email, melvin.warshaw@gmail.com.
Excellent. That'll all be in the show notes. Really interesting stuff. It pains me every time I hear, oh, I'm going to leave the U.S. in a social setting, because I know deep down that it is a brutal exercise and requires so much more thought and preparation than that person usually has given. Thanks so much for your expertise, and we'll look forward to having you back.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Wealth Actually, hosted by Fraser Rice, author of the book Wealth Actually and a leading private wealth manager. Head on over to wealthactually.com, where you can subscribe to this podcast, get your own copy of the Wealth Actually book, and connect with Fraser directly. We'll see you next time on Wealth Actually. Fraser Rice is an employee of Next Capital Management, LLC. This podcast is not investment, legal, or tax advice, nor does it reflect the opinions of Next Capital Management. Any opinions represented in the show are Fraser's individually and not an endorsement of the guest.